Welcome to Geeks On, a show created by geeks for geeks, covering topics that geeks like to talk about. This week, it's Geeks On, the patron saint of science fiction, Forrest Ackerman. You do not want to miss this interview if you are all a fan of science fiction. For more information about the news and links we talk about in the show, go to our website at www.geekson.com.
And back again, Tom.
Welcome!
Hello, my geek
things! Everybody!
Are you ready to geek?
Are you ready to geek?
Oh, come on, not again.
Are you ready to geek?
Come on.
Welcome.
You is no fun, white boy.
It's the same song.
No.
I wasn't geek combat.
I wasn't doing...
Are you ready to geek?
Okay. It's different.
It's a different song.
The geeks are back.
We were out of town.
We were all gone for quite some time to Kansas City.
We're going to Kansas City. Sorry, I'll stop.
You know, I hear they have the Crazy Little Women there.
All I know is they filmed Music Man there.
Yes.
So the entire time I was there, it was me and two little women going, Jaboopy, Jaboopy, Jaboopy.
And them staring at you. Going,
yeah, no one in Kansas knows what the Music Man is, apparently.
But we're back. With another awesome interview.
Yes.
I mean, the fact that we've gotten... we don't normally do interviews this often or two in a row, but we had another opportunity to do an interview that is amazing.
We got a rocking one.
So I can't wait for you guys to hear this. But
this is a man... I mean, we can give a quick intro just so people know what's coming up. Do you want to...
Peter.
No, we're going to do an interview in a minute. We're going to intro him in a minute. Let's do that then.
He speaks about the birth of Scientology. I'm just leaving it at that.
How was your guys' Geek Week?
It was awesome. Did you hear that they're doing a Philip K. Dick biopic on Sci-Fi Channel?
No.
It's going to be really,
biopic?
Really cool. A biopic. Yeah, they're going to be...
You mean biopic?
Maybe. I used to say fanatic as fanatic, too.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I was wondering, like a biopic sounds like a medical procedure.
Paladin is Aladdin.
Yeah. See. All right. Anyway.
I actually pronounced it Paladin because Saladin, you know?
Yeah.
Intriguing, your guys' history with saying words incorrectly. But
yes.
What about the sci-fi? Jeez.
Philip K. Dick biopic.
Yeah. Okay.
In pre-production, Matthew Wilder starring Bill Pullman.
What?
Yeah,
I loved it. So TiVo that, everybody. Yeah.
Bill Pullman is like one of the two famous graduates of my college.
Yeah. I saw another Eureka, and I think I'm going to retire it.
No!
It's not good. Oh. It's no good.
I'm hearing it's mixed things, but it sounds very typical of a first season.
It's no good. I don't like it.
It's like a... first season 80s television show. It's
I know,
got a
that's
really
what's great
heavy,
about it.
Watch Monk. Monk's a better 80s television
right, but
show.
This is a sci-fi 80s
it's not
television
really
show.
Sci-fi.
Okay, I got to say, I saw the most recent episode of Eureka. I was not that impressed with it. But, you know, it's different in tone than the first two or three.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if it's going to be one of those things where it's kind of like X-Files, where they have like a couple good episodes, and they have one that's kind of like this weird, cheesy werewolf episode. Or, you know.
I hear you, but it's pretty bad.
I, on the other hand, have watched the first two episodes of So You Want to Be a Superhero.
Oh, yes!
I saw the first episode and I stopped.
Come on.
Love it.
It's great.
It's one of the worst, best television shows on air.
I am so ashamed to admit it, but I love this show.
Yes, it is. It is great. It is wonderful in its awfulness.
To summarize what the show is, Stan Lee, the legend, the man, the myth, the legend, casts a whole bunch of superheroes from these people who show up at auditions in Los Angeles to say they want to be superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the superheroes there are like, you know, Fat Mama, who's, you know, she runs around in her leotards with donuts on the outside.
Oh, wow.
And what are some of the other? Monkey Girl.
Now, Cell Phone Girl actually had a practical superpower. She can call
the
help.
Chick was so, the chick's so vapid, it just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow.
You know, the strange thing. Remember when we first started the show, I said that I had worked with a woman who had a friend who made action figures, mm-hmm. and you could call him up and he would make an action figure of you or a coworker or whatever. He was the first guy that got kicked off that show.
I know.
I was like, I was watching it going, wait a minute. I think I knew that guy is.
I felt so bad for him. In the first episode, they kick off the first person in the first 15 minutes of the show. And, like, you barely get a chance to recognize his face, and he's gone, mm-hmm. you know?
Right. Poor Maybe guy. I can get interview. I mean, his action figures are pretty awesome, and he has a big web. He has a website with, it looks like maybe about 60 or 70 different action figures that he's made.
We can get him on.
So
let's call him up.
Yeah, maybe just for a little quick interview.
There you go.
But anyway, anybody else have a good geek week?
I am currently listening to the Game of Thrones on audio disc.
Oh, really?
Right.
Oh.
And, okay, it's really good.
Is it? Oh, really?
Yeah. The guy who's doing the reading is very good. He's great with the voices. I just heard him do Tyrion for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm having... Those of you who listen to NPR will know what this means. I'm having driveway moments single day when I get home from work.
So you sit there for a half hour? And...
Yeah, like I'm so embarrassed to admit I need to refill the tank on my car, and I'm like at 100 miles less than I normally am. You know, I'm not proud of this.
Well, maybe I'll pick. I've been trying to listen to some books at night, books on tape at night, mm-hmm. to help me go to sleep, and I was listening to. What's the
George Takei's biography?
Yeah, that put me asleep.
That's horrible.
I'm George
Takei. I was born and raised in the Japanese imprisonment.
What's the Ender's Game sequel? Speaker of the Dead.
Yeah.
And
Shadow of the Hegemon.
Speaker of the Dead. It's just really, first of all, it ain't a sequel.
No, Ender's Game was the good one. The ones that came after that.
It's not a sequel. I'm sorry, but that is an entirely different.
The Ender's Game is an action movie. The rest of them are political.
They're different, yeah. But Ender's Game is the one that's like the most amazing out of the group.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
All right, so you're saying pick up the audio version. It's quite good.
And then you can actually be on the same page as us. Pardon the pun.
Whoa, hey.
Man, unreader.
Moving on. Let's do news. Cue the music.
Geek news.
Cue the music. All right.
God, I love that music. Fantastic. That's just amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
The magic of post-production leaves something to be desired.
Yes. All right. Can I hit it? Please, please, please. Me, please.
Your hands up, Matt.
All right, good. This... From Matt's files of stupid scientific studies that I get specifically to annoy Aaron. Oh, you haven't even heard it yet, Aaron. You're going to love it. I got this specifically to annoy Aaron.
No.
Can landscaping improve or threaten your social calendar? Seriously. If you have a nice lawn instead of a pile of dirt in your front yard, are you more or less likely to socialize with your neighbors? Researchers at Arizona State University in Tempe believe that landscaping has a significant effect on how we interact with others, and they've set up an unusual experiment to find out if they're right. Although the results aren't complete yet, early findings indicate that the lack of a lawn can mow down your social life.
Oh, my God. I can't take it anymore.
It's genius.
Now, wait a minute. First of all, their conclusions seem like it could be faulty.
Well,
maybe it's the type of person who would manicure their lawn is the
themselves.
Type of person who is more social. I mean, they're assuming that it's A... is causing B, but maybe it's A or
well,
B.
Well, maybe they're going to give us some thoughts about why this is so. Well,
okay, so here a couple of things about this is one, it's through Arizona State University. They have school housing, which is identical, right? Each house is identical, but they mm-hmm. have differing lawns, mm-hmm. and it's up to the inhabitant to figure out how you want to landscape your lawn. And so they're running, you know, a blind experiment based on. All of these school housing, hundreds of school housing are identical. I love this experiment.
You know what? You know what they should do? This is a great experiment, or at least a research. They should research how the University of Arizona spends their money, because it seems so bizarre and so out there that I think it's worth a good study.
Here we go. Desert landscaping, even for people who have lived in the desert all their lives, could be deadly when it comes to getting invited to neighborhood parties.
Oh God.
This may be a bit surprising to people who love the desert, but researchers also suggest that the longer people live in the desert, the less they like arid landscaping. This is the best study ever. The experiment will run through 2010, but the researchers have already spent a lot of time observing the social life of their subjects.
I think they should do it longer than 2010. I mean, you know, this is an important study with important ramifications for the world.
Oh, God.
Can we move on? Let's not even give them any more time. No, wait.
I just have to make a point, okay? It's clear. Look, Middle East... No landscaping, no grass. That's the problem with the Middle East. That's no grass.
We need to drop AstroTurf on Palestine.
That's it.
Oh, my God. They sucked me in, Aaron.
How dare you.
Make it stop. All right. I'm starting my new story.
Start your new story.
Cat parasites affect everything we feel and do. I love this.
Are you guys just trying to spin me out?
Let's go. Come on.
Kevin Lafferty is a smart, cautious, thoughtful scientist who doesn't hate cats, but he has put forth a provocative theory that suggests that a clever cat parasite may alter human cultures on a massive scale.
Cat hater.
The parasite, and forgive me, Latin speakers, because I can't say this, Toxoplasma gondii, has been transmitted indirectly from cats to roughly half the people on the planet, and it has been shown to affect human personalities in different ways. Ooh. Research has shown that women who are infected with the parasite tend to be warm, outgoing, and attentive to others, while infected men tend to be less intelligent and probably a bit boring. Both men and women who are...
You're a cat owner, Matt, right?
What? I don't know what you're talking about.
Let's see. Other researchers have linked the parasite to schizophrenia. In an adult, the symptoms are like a mild form of flu, but can be much more serious to an infant or fetus. Oxford University researchers believe high levels of the parasite lead to hyperactivity and lower IQs in children.
Hey,
really?
What are we doing? Where are we going?
Now,
how are we doing it?
Think about that.
That's pretty freaky,
Think about that. That means that these traits, I mean, both of the female trait, at least, is one we tend to associate with being kind of a female trait, you know?
Is that why cat ladies end up being cat ladies? Maybe they get so infected. Maybe they're hyper-infected with this virus so that they become...
Nuts.
Only loving to this cat, and they become nuts.
And they nut, yeah. If you hit three cats... If you're over three cats, ladies, any of you ladies out there have three cats,
but
you're crazy.
That's the Aaron cat limit.
Yeah. And like this article, it's a really interesting article. I recommend you go read it because it talks about how parasites can psychologically affect their hosts in ways I had no idea. Huh.
Parasites in like wolf droppings and stuff like that that will make you go crazy.
Yeah.
Well, check this out. The toxoplasma thing they're talking about, it can change the personality of a rat, right? So much that the rat surrenders itself to a cat just as the parasite wanted. The parasite's eggs are shed in a cat's feces. A rat coming along eats the feces and becomes infected. The behavior of the rat undergoes a dramatic change, making the rat more adventuresome and more likely to hang out around cats.
So it's helping the cat out.
It's helping the cat get to eat
which keeps the parasite alive.
Which keeps its life cycle going from cat to rat to rat to cat.
That's one smart parasite.
If it can do that in rats... There might be some basis to this toxoplasma doing something to us.
That is pretty interesting.
That's really interesting.
I'm not under control.
I'm fine. I'm completely human. I don't know what you're talking about. Stop looking at me.
I'm totally picturing little colonies of toxoplasma in Peter's Bread going like, they're not buying it. Hit the empathy centers.
Aaron, hit it, Chewy.
I am proud to announce that all five captains of the Star Trek series are all going to be doing voiceover for the greatest video game ever to come out.
Oh, God, someone wipe his seat.
Remember, at E3, there was a... actually, it wasn't even demo. They had some...
they had some surly models standing in front of a poster handing out stickers.
No, they had some video... They had a good video there. I have pictures of the
video. Models in front of a poster.
I remember, they had the angriest blonde chick standing in front of there like, yes, I have breasts. Here's a sticker.
You're right. It wasn't a good showing, but there's going to be a Star Trek Starship combat game, a la Starfleet Battles,
right,
coming out for the PC and the Xbox 360. Mm-hmm. And they recently announced that they did get the talent of William Shatner, Patrick Stewart, Scott Bakula, Avery Brooks, and Kate Mulgrew. All of them are going to be doing voiceover.
Is Avery Brooks still going to be pissed off?
Scott Bakula, too, right?
Scott Bakula. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Scott Bakula.
Scotty Bak.
First time that all of the captains all were in one project together working on one. So that will be very cool.
Until the next movie comes out.
Yeah, exactly. And then we can have Captain Kirk saving Picard's ass from Avery Brooks while he saves Kate Mulgrew.
The video game comes out this fall, so everyone look out for it. I'm excited. Xbox 360 Battles
Online.
You're
like vibrating. You are. You're like shaking. You're so excited.
I want Space Combat Online Xbox Live.
Which captain gets to say fire?
I think what happens is a race that comes from the future comes back and threatens the Federation, and that's the reason why it somehow
gets... It's that confluence of times.
Yeah.
That's actually a pretty good idea.
Huh? Yeah.
There you go. Buy it.
So, we all love spammers, right?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah, man.
Because, spammers are great.
I love it.
They are great.
I got a story. All the antivirus.
Them's good people.
Oh, yeah. I got a story about one. So, AOL, back in the day, won $12.8 million from Davis Wolfgang Hawk.
Wow. Who named him?
Boy, I don't know. But they've been unable to collect that money because they can't find him. And on top of that, see, back when Davis was making...
How hard is it to find a guy named Davis Wolfgang Hawk?
He and his partner were making...
He's hanging out with Osama.
Up to $600,000 each month.
How much?
Much of it in cash.
$600,000 a month?
In spam. For spam. They were making up to $600,000 a month.
I got
to
get into some spam.
And but at the same time, this Davis guy is pretty darn smart because he lived like out of a car, basically. He drove a beat up, used cop car.
How's that smart?
He never owned a house. He never owned anything.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
What he did was he went out and he bought a lot of gold. Mm-hmm. Now, AOL is trying to find this gold. So they're going to his parents' house and they want to dig up their yard looking for the gold. The parents are like... come on, give us a break. We haven't seen our son in a year. We're kind of pissed off at him. And he told us he buried it up in the mountains. But look if you want to.
So AOL's digging this guy's...
AOL is trying to dig up this guy's parents' yard. Interesting.
Wow.
Huh?
That's like that old joke about the guy who's... He receives a letter from his father who's dying. And his father says, I know you're in jail and you can't help me. But, I'm still out in the backyard and I'm putting together everything. I'm trying to garden every day, but my back hurts, my feet hurt. And his son writes back a letter that says, "Dad, don't mention it, but I hid the money in the back right corner of your backyard, so don't dig there." And the next day, the FBI come in and they just plow through his whole black backyard and they clear the room and everything like that. And the son writes another letter saying, "Is that all right, Dad? I hope, they got all the stones out of the way and got everything exactly you wanted. I couldn't be there, but
I did help you out.
I did help you out.
That's the best thing I could do. That's actually pretty funny.
I love it. Excellent. So, along with the nature of our interviewee in a second, in Maine, there's a mystery beast that was killed by a car. Now,
really?
This thing,
I haven't seen B. Arthur in a couple weeks.
Actually.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, it wasn't like, "Hey, how you doing? Good to see you, Rose." No. It was, it's this crazy thing. Now, you look at the pictures online, this thing looks like a werewolf.
They have pictures.
It's dead. It's nice. It looks like a werewolf.
Okay.
It's sort of bluish black, and it's got, in one picture, almost a human-like snout. It's weird looking.
If we want to get mentioned on Dragon's Landing podcast, we can just call it Chupacabra.
Because they,
it could be a chupacabra, but it looks more like some sort of wolfy thing.
Huh.
The wild northern chupacabra of northern Maine.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Basically, this thing has mauled dogs, frightened residents. It's literally been there for half a generation. Okay. However long half a generation is, that long, it's been freaking people out. It's got these weird, freaky eyes that light up at night. It's been scaring people. It's killed a Doberman. It's killed a Rottweiler.
But we have the body now.
The animal was found near power lines along Route 4 on Saturday, apparently struck by a car while chasing a cat.
Okay, so why isn't this made national news that we just found a new creature?
Well, the carcass was photographed and inspected by several people who live in the area. Nobody's sure exactly what it is. Michelle O'Donnell of Turner spotted the animal near her yard about a week before it was killed. She called it a hybrid mutant of something.
Okay.
It was on the news 12 hours ago.
Yeah.
Oh.
So it's pretty freaky. Nobody is sure what it is, but...
Looks like a dog.
Yeah, there's another picture. You click on that one, because it's the snout.
Snout that's really weird. Yeah, people are asking if it's a mystery beast. They think that it's a wolf-dog hybrid of some kind. But, I mean, it's
blue.
It looks vaguely human, yeah.
It's blue and it's weird looking, and it looks vaguely human. Like,
and we'll
put
a link to the weird pictures.
Yeah, that's just bizarre.
Great radio that we're talking about.
Absolutely. But they think it's a wolf-dog hybrid. They don't know for sure, but they think it's probably like a coyote weird dog. It looks like a werewolf. And it's huge.
It really does look like a werewolf from The Howling One.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. From The Howling One.
Criminy.
That's freaky.
Yes. Anyway, there we are.
Casual gaming is taking the place of daily activities. A substantial minority of American adults would rather spend their time playing casual games, such online diversions as Bejeweled and Text Twist, than watch television. A study by Harris Interactive set for release Monday found
Aaron's
that
wife.
31% of the over 18 set preferred the games to TV while whiling away a spare hour or so. Watching movies at home fared better, with 21% choosing games instead, but going to the movie theater did slightly worse with 35%.
Hmm.
You can do what my wife does, which is watch television.
She multitasks.
And plays the games at the same time.
Again, that's one of the reasons why I prefer PC games. I like playing a game and watching television.
Oh, yeah, I don't know if my wife has actually seen any of the actors on Law & Order.
I have seen you try and change the channel while she's doing that, and she snaps your freaking head off.
I know, but I could just record it on audio and just play it and then play my video. I mean, she doesn't look up. So what's the point, you know?
No, I bet you she does. Just very briefly, very quickly, to get a kind of snap picture of what's going on.
I guess.
That's what I do.
I guess. Huh. Interesting. Well, you know, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, the television industry they're getting worried.
It's taken over. And these casual games, right? Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of research on them in the past couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I am really impressed by what I'm seeing. Mm-hmm. It seems like more thought goes into the game design on these things than the main, like high-profile video games.
Yeah,
put
like Diner Dash, for God's sakes, was fun.
One of the most addictive things I've ever played. Diner Dash 2 is wonderful.
But again, it's
Puzzle
because,
Pirates, okay. I'll plug it again.
I'm totally addicted. I've been playing that.
Have you?
Yeah, and so has Matt. Matt's played it a couple times.
I played it a few times, yeah.
But yeah, it's a lot of fun, and as you uncover more puzzles, it's great.
It's because the entire game is relying on the gameplay to keep you entertained.
Yes.
Some of these major video games are coming out. They've got storylines. They got surround sound audio. They have visuals that will knock your socks off. And they aren't necessarily relying on a gameplay to keep you interested. All they have to do is put some fancy
lights. I think a lot of them depend on the same thing that the high-profile special effects movies do. Which is, they don't really think about plot. They don't really think about dialogue.
Yeah,
they don't really think about story structure. They just think they're going to throw a lot of special effects at you, give you a big gun, and you'll be happy.
Yeah.
And the palate of most people who play those games is more sophisticated than that.
Yeah, that's right.
The developers don't give them the credit.
I'm curious to see how the Xbox Live arcade, mm-hmm. and which I'm sure Sony will have the same exact type of thing, they're starting to make a bigger deal about those games because they're understanding that a lot of people are downloading these little mini games, mm-hmm. and playing a lot of it.
I predict that there'll be more of a rush to the 360 for those games, mm-hmm. when casual multiplayer games start coming up.
Yep.
Right now,
like Uno.
Like Uno.
Like right. Puzzle yeah. Pirates. Like, let me tell you.
We're saying Uno on the 360 already.
Oh, right.
Yeah, you know, Uno is the biggest, fastest-selling game on the Xbox 360. Yeah. It was like $5, and everybody's buying it. It's there. You can sit there.
And play Uno?
Chit-chat with four other people with almost zero brain cells being burned, and just play a little Uno.
Huh.
I haven't had the time to play video games lately, but as soon as I do, I'm going to buy Uno, and we're going to play.
We'll play. And it's got the camera... feature. So when the camera comes out in September, you'll be able to hook up. Then Uno is going to get real good.
Oh, goody.
Naked. Okay. Speaking of video games, Gen Con, which is the big board game / role-playing convention that goes on. And
I've always thought of it as a role-playing thing, but it really is for board games too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's everything. And there is a big one here in Southern California as well, Gen Con SoCal. Well, the owners of Gen Con have announced that because of E3 changing, the trade show changing, that they're opening up Gen Con to incorporate video games.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So,
as is Comic-Con, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, Comic-Con already did. So, Gen Con is getting big enough that they are in Southern California that they're going to move in 2007. Yeah, 2007 is going to be at the LA Convention Center.
Wait, they're that big that fast?
They're saying because of the video games, they will not be able to have it at like the hotel or whatever.
Wow.
That they're going to have it. Now,
that's some quick growth.
Okay, now let me understand what's going on here.
Yeah.
The video game industry has decided that it is too much for them to create videos and demos and booths
for the big guys.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. It's not the video game industry. It is the biggest investors, the biggest publishers in the video game industry have decided.
The guy who thinks their coattails are being hung on.
Right, okay. But do you think that Sony, Xbox, EA, and Activision are not going to be there?
I don't know. We'll
probably see. Not to the scale that they have been at E3.
I
predict that their stands will be a smaller scale.
Okay.
And I think it's smarter for these big name players in the video game industry to just direct market to their sellers.
Yeah, because they already have an advertising budget on TV. So
we've already been over this before. Yeah, why spend $3 million pitching your stuff at a convention where other people are going to leech off the buzz that you're trying to generate?
But I'm just seeing
when
I'm
you can spend $1 million to fly out these buyers.
No, I understand that, but I'm just seeing another convention that they're opening up for video games again.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see. We'll see.
But
by the way,
Activision's already at all these places. So is EA. Yeah. You know.
So, by the way, what do you guys feel about video games intruding on a game convention?
I think it's awesome.
I don't think it's a good idea.
I think it's great.
I think it's a smart idea for the convention. I think it's a smart idea for the video game people. I think it's bad news for the role players and the board gamers.
Well, that's how could it be smart for the convention if it kills off the convention's the really for?
The convention will probably never be in danger of dying because they introduce a new element.
I think that the booth babes will make the role players smell a whole lot better because they will be self-conscious.
Good luck. All right, that's it for me.
So how backwater do you think the United States is?
I'm scared to answer that question.
Well, they did a study in 2005. They surveyed people in the United States in 32 European countries, and they were asked whether to respond true or false or not sure to this statement. Human beings, as we know them, developed from earlier species of animals. Basically, they're saying, does evolution exist?
Evolution exists.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Commonly accepted scientific theory. Okay. Mm-hmm. United States was the second highest percentage of adults who said it did not exist, that you could said false.
Was not a valid theory.
It was not a valid theory.
What was the first?
Turkey. Oh. Out of European, this is not like out of the world. This is out of like the EU, type of places.
The EU and the United States.
And the United States. So, we're pretty backwater.
Again, I have to throw this out here. I argue with my wife about this. If you truly believe, if you go to church, Well, actually, they can exist, I guess.
The Catholic Church admits that evolution exists.
Yeah, evolution and creative or intelligent design, I guess, is not exclusive. So
No, not at all. You know,
That's interesting that they
It depends which intelligent design you're talking about.
Well, true.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Actually, just in brief, I have another article, but I won't go into it. It just follows up what you're talking about. There is a group of Christian students suing the University of California system for discrimination because they were not admitted under because their school teaches intelligent design, not evolution. Hmm. So because they did not fulfill the requirements of the college, who requires a scientific background in that area, they are suing for entry.
Oh, please. Let's go pull some drama students. Never mind.
All right. We'll find the link for that, and we'll have that on our show, too. All right. Can we move forward to
the interview?
That's right.
The interview of Forrest J. Ackerman!
Ackerman.
So it just so happens...
Forry to his friends.
Yeah, so it just so
Not
happens
us.
That one of our neighbors in our neighborhood here happens to be one of the biggest science fiction patrons on the planet.
Yeah, you really can't narrow him down to a niche because patron is the right word because he's been involved.
He's the patron saint of sci-fi.
He has had such a love affair with sci-fi over the years.
He's a writer.
He's a publisher.
He's a publisher.
He's an agent.
Actor.
He's a collector.
Yeah. In fact, we're about to go through this in a second in the interview. We're going to give him a great introduction. Let's jump into the interview.
Let's check it out.
Excellent.
So we have a special guest tonight, Forrest J. Ackerman.
The man, the myth, the legend.
Who has a long and loving history in the world of sci-fi. Mr. Ackerman has done everything you can do in the sci-fi industry. He's been a writer, a publisher, an actor, and is considered the ultimate sci-fi fan.
Well, in fact, didn't he create the term sci-fi?
In fact, he did create the term sci-fi.
Interesting, Dad.
He actually invented costuming as well when he was the very first person to ever dress up in a costume when attending a comic convention. He was also the creator of the magazine Famous Monsters in Filmland, introducing the history of science fiction and fantasy to a generation of young readers. Today, he's renowned for his Ackerman mini mansion filled with sci-fi memorabilia from famous movies, science fiction, and horror alike.
Which is... In our neighborhood.
Exactly. Who knew?
And he is also credited with nurturing and even inspiring the careers of several early contemporaries like Ray Bradbury, Ray Harryhausen, Charles Beaumont, Marion Zimmer Bradley, and L. Ron Hubbard of Scientology fame.
Man.
He was also Ed Wood's illiterary agent and represents 200 authors of science fiction. Represented. Illiterary.
Okay, this demands some explanation later on.
I'm sure he will. And it will be his 90th birthday in November.
Excellent. Welcome.
Birthday. Welcome,
Thank
Mr. Ackerman.
Thank you so much for coming. Welcome to Geeks On.
Well, I guess I can go now. You just sort of covered my entire life.
Now it's all details.
Yes, we need to get the good stuff.
How did you come to name sci-fi? The question has to be asked.
Well, I was riding around my automobile, 1954, had the radio on, and some mention was made of science fiction. And since science fiction had been on the tip of my tongue ever since 1928, when it was first introduced in a magazine called Science Wonder Stories, I looked in the rear view mirror, stuck out my tongue, and there, tattooed on the end of my tongue, was sci-fi. And to her immortal embarrassment, my dear wife said, "Forget it, Forry. It will never catch on."
Now, did it have anything to do with the radio being like hi-fi stereo or anything like that?
Absolutely. The hi-fi turned me on to sci-fi. If I'd been a detective reader, I might have invented spy-fi.
Exactly.
Okay, so I have another question that's related to that then. If I create a term in this room today, how do I get everybody else to use it? Like, okay, so you go from the car, there's sci-fi's been born. Now, how does everybody else find out about this new term?
Well, at the time, there were many science fiction magazines, and I had a column in one of them. So in the magazine called Imagination, in my column, I introduced the term sci-fi, and it immediately caught on. But it caught in the throat of a spec-fic author. I was once present when he gave a lecture, and he said, "You must never, ever, under any circumstances, use the abominable, the nauseous sci-fi phooey. What is it? It's the sound of two crickets screwing." I thought, gee, you might, must really have your ear down in the dirt to hear two crickets screwing. So I got down to Australia for the World Science Fiction Convention, and a young fan came and proudly showed me a button that he had created. "I love copulating crickets."
So it already made it down to the land down under, so I guess it was going to stick for sure.
Exactly. Now, was that Harlan Ellison who...
Oh, well, you've got to talk dirty. I'm going to do this.
Now, we know that you were seminal in a lot of people's lives, a lot of science fiction writers' lives. I also understand that you had a lot to do with Ray Bradbury and his success. Could you tell us some stories about how you met him and nurtured his career?
Well, I really think Ray Bradbury is a self-starter, but in the early days when he was standing on the corner selling newspapers for 2 cents a copy, whenever he wanted to take a girl on a date, it could be done for a dollar. It was 5 cents for a streetcar ride to the downtown Picture Palace, 5 cents for bottomless popcorn, 21 cents for a movie. You might even have a few cents left over. Well, I was always good a buck for a book. He would bring me a book, and I would finance his date. One time he had an extra hot date because he needed $2. And for the extra dollar, he showed me a copy of the novelization of King Kong by Edgar Wallace. And he said, "Look, Forry, it's autographed by Edgar Wallace. That ought to be worth an extra dollar." Well, I was young and naive. I didn't stop to question, how did this high school kid get the autograph of this famous British author 6,000 miles away? I gave him the extra dollar. Many years later, he was at one of my birthday parties, and his eye fell upon that copy of King Kong that he had sent me, and he looked kind of embarrassed, and he took it off the shelf, and he said, "Oh, Forry, I have a terrible confession to make. I wrote that Edgar Wallace." I said, "You dirty dog, give me back my dollar." So I realized he regretted he ever sold me that. And by now it was a rather expensive collector's item, but I managed to get another copy of King Kong, and I inscribed it to Ray Bradbury from the real Edgar Wallace.
That's fantastic. Do you have a favorite story of Ray's? A favorite specific science fiction story of Ray Bradbury's?
One of my favorites of his stories? Mm-hmm. Yes, it's one where I can tell you the plot, but I always forget the name of it. It's a man in a time machine who went 100 years into the future, and he came back and he told everybody, "Oh, the world is wonderful. No more wars, no more rape, no more hunger. Just utopia. So the world realized, well, if it's going to be that, we're going to have to straighten up and fly right. And in his time machine, he had flown around the world. So 100 years passed, and everybody's looking up in the sky to see him, and he didn't appear. And they questioned him, and he said, well, I lied.
That's a good one.
That's fantastic.
Now, you also knew L. Ron Hubbard?
Oh, well,
I'm curious.
Yes, I did know him, not really as a Dianeticist or Scientologist, but as an author. One time on Hollywood Boulevard, there was a little secondhand book and magazine shop, run by a grand old gal named Lucy B. Shepherd. We call it Shep Shop. And she had a bulbous red beer nose that would have been the envy of W.C. Fields. And one time I was coming to pay out with some magazines I had bought, and there was a rough-and-tumble redhead in front of me. He was paying, and he mentioned that he just got the world record for gliding. I never knew whether he meant he'd been in the air the longest time or gone the longest distance or gone the highest. But then he mentioned, he said, oh, you know, all these secondhand magazines you have here, I have stories in all of them, in Western Magazine and Air Wonder and Mystery and Romance. And I was waiting, hoping to hear the magic word science fiction, but I didn't hear it. So I spoke up. I said, oh, did you ever write any science fiction? He said, no, but 45 years from now, there could be a new ice age here in Southern California, and he was off and running, and just on the tip of his tongue telling a science fiction story. If it had been recorded, I think it could have been sold. Well, after 3 years, 5 months, and 29 days of World War II, when I became a civilian again, I looked around in my mind to wonder what I could do to keep body and non-existent soul together. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I think life has prepared me to be a literary agent specializing in science fiction. And before I knew it, I had acquired 200 authors of science fiction.
Wow. Wow.
And I remembered L. Ron Hubbard, who in the meantime had become quite successful as a science fiction and fantasy author. So I contacted him and signed him up to represent him. Toward the end of his life, when he was making so much money he didn't need any more, he gave me a very generous offer. Basically, as an agent, I was entitled to 15% of whatever was paid for a person's property, but he volunteered to give me 50% because he wasn't concerned about money. He was more anxious to have his name remembered as a science fiction author. He was a major hypnotist, and at one time in our science fiction club, he hypnotized most of the members. I just didn't participate. I wanted to watch what was happening. And a young fella came and showed me in the palm of his hand a little kangaroo was jumping around. And then Hubbard said, pretty soon the telephone will ring, when there wasn't even a telephone on a wall, but said, you will answer and someone will make you a wonderful offer of a brand new automobile. But no matter how good the offer, you will keep refusing it for some reason. So the kid went and held an imaginary telephone. He said, I could have it for $100? That's great, but you see, I just have $100 in the bank for my rent. I could have it for $25. Well, he finally got down where he could have it for free or even be paid to take it. And then Hubbard said, well, when I bring you up to realization, I'll just scratch my nose and you'll go instantly asleep. I was standing behind the boy and everybody was crowded around Ron, and his nose actually itched. And the kid fell right back, fortunately, into my arms.
Wow. Amazing.
All right, really funny.
Did it surprise you at all the direction that L. Ron Hubbard eventually went at all?
Well, I believe at one time he's quoted as saying, if you want to become a millionaire, create a new religion. And he certainly made that statement come true.
You said one of the things he was most concerned about towards the end of his life was how he would be remembered. Do you think L. Ron Hubbard would be happy with the way he's remembered today?
I don't think so, because he's not remembered so much for his science fiction as the turn that Scientology has taken. I was interested. I wasn't participating in Scientology, but I was interested in what was going on. And I finally parted company with it when I was told one of the people involved had been taken way back to primordial times when he was a clam and he was being irritated by a grain of sand to form a pearl. And I thought that's a little too fantastic for me.
Too much science fiction?
Too fantastic for the father of sci-fi.
Yeah.
You know you've gone too far when.
Now, you were the agent of Ed Wood at one point.
No, really?
Oh, that's so cool.
His hero.
I love Ed Wood.
The illiterary agent. Yeah.
What does that mean?
Ed Wood. Frankly, Ed to me was mainly a drunken voice at 2 o'clock in the morning on the telephone babbling incomprehensible things.
Well, he seemed to be more relentless than maybe talented. You know what I mean? Like, he made sure things happened, whether it was nagging or just relentlessly pursuing what he wanted. At least he made it happen. You know what I mean?
Did you enjoy his movies? That's a thoughtful answer.
No comment.
Brilliant. Now, I understand that you met, you had a perhaps unfortunate encounter when you met Cyril M. Kornbluth on a train once?
Not on a train, but at the end of a train. I was a really shy, introverted boy when I was 21, and I was on the train going to New York to attend the first World Science Fiction Convention. I trembled with every clickety-clack of the railroad track, afraid that I might be in the audience and somebody would notice me and they say, "Oh, Mr. Ackerman, won't you stand a moment?" I thought, "Oh my God, what if somebody asked me to stand? You know, I'll be paralyzed." And I was about ready to turn around and go back when he got as far as Chicago and had to change trains, but I mustered up my courage and went on. And when I arrived in New York, there was a little group of fans waiting to greet me, Donald Wolheim and the lady who eventually became his wife. And among them, there was a surly-looking individual, a young fellow with kind of a pot belly, and he was dribbling cigarette ashes down, and he looked me up and down disdainfully, and he said, "So you're the Forrest Ackerman who's been writing all those ridiculous letters to the magazines." And Cyril Kornbluth punched me in the stomach.
No.
And I thought, well, welcome to Fun City.
So, it sounded like you did a lot of traveling from science fiction conventions, comic book conventions. Did that change a lot throughout the years? I mean, have those conventions changed for you? It seems like they're getting bigger with more people, but as far as content and...
Well, originally, there were so few science fiction magazines that the fans were able to read every story in every one of them, and then they began to proliferate, and one time there were 50 science fiction magazines a month, and it was no longer possible for everybody to read everything.
Mm-hmm.
When the San Diego Comic-Con was created, they needed somebody as the guest of honor to attract fans, and they chose me as their first guest.
Wow.
And for the first Comic-Con, there were 145 fans attended.
That's it?
And we were so excited, we thought, maybe eventually there will be 200. And recently they had to turn fans away because after the 100,300 were in, there was no longer any room for.
Yeah, that happened this year when we went. It was crazy. There were fans lined up out down the street on the sidewalk. It's amazing.
And I hear they're going to move it to the LA Convention Center next year because the San Diego one is just too small now.
Yep.
That's a big science fiction convention.
So it's a shorter commute for you.
Yeah, you can go next year.
Well, at my 89th birthday, I had 300 fans. I'm looking forward, I think 10 years from now, when I have my 100th birthday, may have to celebrate it in the Hollywood Bowl.
That's great.
We'll be there.
Now, speaking of Comic-Con, you were the first person, you were the creator of costuming. You were the creator of attending comic conventions dressed up as a character.
Which, considering how skimpy things have gotten lately, thank you.
Could you tell us a little bit about when you went the first time dressed as a character and who you went
with?
Well,
the first convention was the first of all science fiction conventions in 1939. It was not oriented toward comics. But I thought it probably all the fans were going to come in costumes, and I had a significant other at the time, and I described to this woman, Maroyo, kind of a costume I would want, which is a combination of the one worn in the shape of things to come, and the so-called balloon pants that artist Frank R. Paul featured. So I wore that at the first convention in 1939 and was the only one in costume. I went out the World Fair, had a microphone, and people were invited to step up and greet the world in Swedish or Japanese or whatever their native language was. And I addressed the world in Esperanto. I said, I am a time traveler from the future. But everybody was so enthusiastic about my costume that at the Second World Convention, 1940, in Chicago, 25 fans turned up as spacemen and werewolves and vampires and zombies and so on. And about 8 o'clock at night, I got a quixotic notion. I said, come on, fans, follow me. And we walked through the streets of Chicago, 8 blocks to the headquarters of a major newspaper of the day. And I went up to the night editor, and all these costumed fans were behind me. And with a straight face, I said, sir, we are time travelers. We read your newspaper tomorrow, and we noticed that there was a photograph of us and an interview, so we realized we have to come back tonight.
To make the time, so there wasn't a paradox. You had to show up.
Right.
Exactly.
You don't want to.
It's really just basic consideration. When
you know what a paradox is. Two doctors.
So did they do the interview?
The night editor had no imagination.
Oh man!
In an alternate universe, it would have happened. It just surfaces. I wonder, did you fellas see on television about the school teacher who was cross-eyed?
No.
She couldn't control her pupils.
Oh.
Or did you hear about the cafe on the moon?
No. Is that the one that has good food but no atmosphere?
Good food, that's right, but no atmosphere.
He stole his punchline.
Punch that mine.
I got attacked by force.
Now, so over the years, you've met a lot of luminaries in the sci-fi industry. My personal favorite author was Isaac Asimov. Did you ever run into Asimov and, you know, over the years? And what did you think of him?
I sure did. Asimov, and I was very honored at one time. Ike actually kissed me on the forehead I don't know just exactly what the
event was.
What that signified, but I was Ray Bradbury is another one who has kissed me on the I guess I'm unlucky I'm not gay.
So many opportunities.
But Asimov let me sell some of his early stories for translations overseas. I once heard that the last words that Ike ever spoke were, I am still Isaac Asimov. When I first met my wife, her first words to me, she was a clerk and I was bringing some books to buy, and her first words were, may I help you, sir? And the last words of her life were, help me for you. We had 41 wonderful years together, but we got mugged in Italy And I've heard it said, see Naples and die. And it took on a sinister significance because she lost her life 17 years ago.
That's tragic. That's
awful.
Moving maybe towards a slightly more happier, hopefully, track, we know that one of your favorite films is Metropolis.
I love that film.
That you have seen it.
Well, I don't know it's a favorite. I've seen it 105 times trying to make up my mind. Right. But I was very fortunate. One time in Munich, I was in the home of Brigitte Helm, who was the leading lady in it, and I knew Karl Freund, the photographer, and in particular I knew Fritz Lang, the director. One of the most flattering moments of my life, I was with him in Rio de Janeiro at a science fiction film festival, and they showed Metropolis, and they asked Lang to stand and fend questions, and he said, anything you want to know about Metropolis, ask my friend Forrest Ackerman. He knows more about it than I do.
Have you? Are there any movies you've seen more than Metropolis?
No. Films like Frankenstein, Dracula, Things to Come, and King Kong, I've probably seen 25 to 50 times. Just the other night, I was quite honored at the Aero Theater nearby Santa Monica. On the marquee, it said Forrest J. Ackerman. And I was on the stage before the showing of the original animated King Kong, and I told the audience quite a few interesting things about it. I said several years ago, Ray Harryhausen, the great animator, and I were on a stage in London for a revival of the original, and afterwards, as I was walking through the audience, a lady came up to me and she said, sir, were you the man in the gorilla suit? I said, oh, no, I was too young. That was my father.
Well, that was flattering.
And a young man once told me that King Kong and I had saved his life. He was down in the dumps and was contemplating committing suicide. And he got the new issue of My Famous Monsters of Filmland with a cover of King Kong by Basil Gogos. And he was avidly, it was his favorite film, and he was reading the fictionization that I had written about it. All of a sudden, it said, to be continued. So he had to wait a month to read the end. By then, he was out of the mood of killing himself.
Wow. Lucky for those words, yeah, to exactly. be continued.
It's sort of a cliffhanger in reverse.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you seen the new King Kong?
I've seen the new King Kong. Right off the bat, the thing that displeases me is that Kong actually is presented as a giant gorilla. In the original, he was not a gorilla. He was just a kind of an imaginary ape of some sort that mm-hmm. never did exist. And I found it much more interesting than being a giant gorilla.
Oh, he was more of a monster back then than now, which was just a large animal.
Hmm. So he was sort of a mutant offshoot of a gorilla within the original story, is what you're saying?
You're right. It was like a hairy beast more than mm-hmm. anything.
That's really interesting.
Could you tell us about how you created the magazine, The Famous Monsters of Filmland, when you created it, how it came about?
I had been over in Paris on a bit of a vacation, and I picked up a movie magazine that ordinarily was about every kind of film under the sun, but this particular issue had a cover of The Werewolf of London, and inside there were stories on King Kong, The Invisible Man, Frankenstein, and so on. So I bought one for my collection. Then I got to New York, and I met James Warren, the publisher of a magazine at the time called After Hours, which was kind of a poor man's Playboy. And he was looking around for material to publish in what was called a one-shot. It could have been about the Beatles or Marilyn Monroe or anything popular at the time, not expecting to go on and be regularly published. So he took one look at this French magazine, and in his mind eye he could see the French turning into English, and he thought he would just write over and he could borrow all the stills. But there were two things against it. When it was translated, it seemed kind of dry and didactic. He didn't think it would appeal to an American audience. And also the stills in it had not come from a single individual, but a half a dozen. And they were not about to lend them to him. So I spoke up. I said, well, I've seen all these films since 1922, and I have 35,000 stills. I think I could create such a magazine. In those days, there were 13 different outfits that distributed magazines around the United States. And Warren went around, and not one of the 13 potential distributors was interested. When all of a sudden, the film I Was a Teenage Werewolf became such a success that there was a sequel, I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, and Life magazine ran an 8-page feature about this new teenage horror genre. And one distributor remembered this madman who tried to interest him, and he called him back and he said, okay, just put monsters on the cover and aim it at kids. So next thing I knew, I was sitting in a old-fashioned mechanical typewriter, and the publisher was sitting opposite me holding up a sign, Forrest Ackerman, I'm 11 and a half years old, and I am your reader. Make me laugh. Well, I had no intention of being funny about Frankenstein or King Kong or anything, but that was what he wanted, so I did my best to satisfy it. 6 weeks after the first issue appeared, I was in a swimming pool with people who didn't know me from the proverbial Adam. And one mother said, you wouldn't believe the magazine my kid brought home with all kind of messed up faces. And there was one of a mummy, and it said he fell into a swimming pool and became an instant mud pie. And everybody in the swimming pool was laughing, and I thought, gosh, that came out of my fingers just 6 weeks ago.
So really, your collection actually allowed you to create your magazine.
Yes.
How long had you been collecting before you were able to start the magazine? And how long have you been collecting your whole life?
I wasted the first 9 years of my life. But in October 1926, at the corner of Santa Monica and Western, a magazine called Amazing Stories jumped off the newsstand, grabbed hold of me. And you listeners are probably too young to know, but in those days, magazines spoke. And that one said, "Take me home, little boy. You will love me." And everything developed from that single October 1926 Amazing Stories.
So what type of things did you collect then? Photos or magazines only? Or what was...
Well, in my time, I collected 50,000 science fiction books, complete collections of 200 different science fantasy magazines.
Did you read the books? Did you read all the books?
I read every last word in my collection. I just turned to the last page and read the last word. Well, in 1932, Carl Laemmle, the president of Universal Studios, had a monthly column in a movie magazine where he spoke about current Universal movies and forthcoming, and he invited readers who saw a Universal film to write and give their opinion. Before I knew it, I had exchanged 62 letters with Carl Laemmle, and he told me things like, we are preparing a film for Boris Karloff called A Trip to Mars, which unfortunately never did eventuate, and I would make all kinds of suggestions to him. Finally, on his president's stationery, he wrote a note, "Give this kid anything he wants." So I wanted press books and stills and posters, and at that time, sound was on huge discs instead of little squiggles on the side of the film. Mm-hmm. So I got the sound discs from Frankenstein and Murders in the Rue Morgue and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Only problem was my old-fashioned Victrola played things at 78 revolutions per minute. And this was a new 33 and a third. So I had to kind of try to dampen things down to get it just right. And I would get curious results like Colin Clive saying, "It's alive, it's alive, it's alive, it's alive, it's alive." When I met Bela Lugosi, I took Murders in the Rue Morgue, and he was kind of deaf and cupped his ear, and he heard himself say, "My name is Dr. Miracle, and I am not a sideshow charlatan. So if you're looking for the usual hocus pocus, just go to the box office and get your money back." And he laughed and he absented himself from the room, and he came back a moment later wearing the Dracula cape, which is now on display in my Ackermini mansion. And my wife and I befriended him and made a point of inviting him to parties in our home and taking him to other parties. And one time I drove him out on Miracle Mile to have a set of shoes resoled, and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "I don't know why you young people are so good to me." And I said, "Well, Bela, you were very good to us, you know. You entertained us mightily as White Zombie and Dracula and all of your films." shook his head and departed. I was with him just 2 weeks before he died, and I was the 101st person to pass by his coffin at his funeral, and I looked at him. I thought, well, if you're looking over my shoulder in spirit form as yourself, Bela, you will be very pleased with your final performance. You almost expected him just to rise and the director to call cut.
Wow. That's fantastic.
That is utterly fantastic.
I just surfaced as I remembering John Carradine played Dracula on the stage in New York at one time. And he said when he came out for a curtain call afterwards, he said to the audience, if I am supposed to be dead, how come I have to take a pee?
That's funny.
Do you have one specific item in your collection that's sort of the keystone or the most prized item in your collection?
Well, my most kind of a toss-up between Bela the Ghost Dracula cape and his Dracula ring. Wow. And Boris Karloff's mummy ring.
Wow.
And
we got to come over to your house and see your museum.
Yeah.
And Vincent Price gave me his very last autograph.
Vincent Price gave you his last autograph?
Yeah.
Wow.
What?
Wow.
That's awesome.
And when Vincent was flying over to Barcelona to meet up with me for a fantasy film festival, this was 15 years after Boris Karloff had died, he said during the flight, a lady came to him and said, oh, sir, could I have your autograph? I can't tell you how many years I've enjoyed your films, Mr. Karloff. So Vincent Price brought Boris Karloff back to life, the only autograph 15 years after he died.
That is funny.
And people used to think that Vincent and I were pretty much lookalikes, and when they couldn't afford him in the film, they got me for half price.
Now, have I heard correctly that you also met Boris Karloff at some point?
One wonderful hour, every word that came out of Boris Karloff's mouth, I had written into it a script for a Decca record album called Boris Karloff and His Friends. And after the recording was completed, we all gathered around him, and one fan, realizing his advancing years, said, Mr. Karloff, you've just done the job of a man about one-third of your age. Can you give us any helpful hint how you accomplished that? He said, well, I don't know, gentlemen. I guess good, clean living up to the age of six.
Getting away from all the people you've met and known, because it seems
which
to be
is
endless.
Amazing.
Amazing.
While it surfaces, as I met Marlene Dietrich.
Really?
When I was 15 years old, shook hands with her and left me shaking for a week. I didn't wash my hand. There was a young actor opposite her just doing his second role. I don't know if he ever, like Marlena, went on to mount anything. Cary Grant?
You know, it out of all the things that you've done in your life, I mean, I'm trying to pin one specific thing. It seems like, really, that you're a patron of science fiction. We have a lot of listeners who are big fans of science fiction, big fans of horror and fantasy. How do we contribute to science fiction and fantasy like you have. I mean, we want to help. We want to help science fiction too. So what do you have to tell us and our listeners? What can we do to evolve science fiction?
Well, I think you're doing it right here and now, in interviewing me recently. Four young ladies from Korea, mm-hmm. who are all students of a science fiction class, came to interview the master, so to speak, and I told them things similar to what I'm telling you now. Just the other day, for 2 hours in the morning, they started to interview me for what is going to be called a documentary, mm-hmm. about my life. They will continue to come back till I finally completely covered it. After 2 hours with me in the morning, they took me over to Ray Bradbury's home, and the two of us reminisced about our sci-fi life together for the last 75 years.
Wow.
That'll be included in the Ackerman documentary, and they're going to interview John Landis and Joe Dante and probably Silverberg and Spielberg and Lucas and other people that say have influenced them.
That sounds like a great documentary.
That would be a fantastic.
I can't wait till that comes out.
Moving more towards the craft of writing, I'm kind of curious, since you are such a fan of great movies, of great stories, can you tell us what is it in your eyes that makes a great story, science fiction or otherwise?
Well, to make the story believable, no matter how unbelievable it is, yes, I think it was Einstein said that imagination is one of the most important things that the individual could have, more than most anything, imagination. And a really good science fiction or fantasy story depends on imagination. I'm thinking of a novel called Four-Sided Triangle by William F. Temple, and The World Below by S. Fowler Wright, and The Forever War. These are all gripping stories that really inspire one to think after them and wonder about them and discuss them.
That makes a lot of sense. Could you tell us your favorite three novels?
My favorite three novels? Well, I guess I just got through naming them.
How about
the Four-Sided Triangle, The World Below, and The Forever War? My wife had not been a fan of war because she had gone through the bombing of London and early Israel, but she read The Forever War, and she was so enthusiastic when she met the author, she actually threw her arms around him and gave him a big kiss of congratulation.
Are there any novels that you think should have been turned into films but were neglected?
Yes, I'm still waiting to see Slan made into a movie, and Childhood's End.
Oh, Arthur C. Clarke, brilliant book. And, brilliant book.
They've made Four-Sided Triangle twice, but it's never done it right. All I really have to do is just turn the pages and film them. First time my wife and I were seeing a preview of it, and it was so dreadful that people kept going up the aisle not to get popcorn or Coke, but leave. Finally, we were the only two people left in the audience at the end. And then it was remade by a French-Italian combination, and it was worse than ever. It was some kind of a surrealistic, incomprehensible thing, and I'm hoping before the end of my life to see a really
good version,
proper version of it.
A lot of fans of science fiction, everyone in this room, I think, kind of see science fiction as being a blueprint for the future, kind of something that lays out the way the future could be or the way it should not be. Do you feel that the science fiction you've created has helped create the world we live in now?
Yes, I think science fiction has been kind of a blueprint of the future that like Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, for instance, show us in an alternate universe the danger. At one time, I climbed 451 feet up the Great Wall of China in honor of Ray Bradbury.
Well, we just wanted to tell you that you've been incredibly gracious with your time, and
thank you so much.
We very much appreciate coming in.
You're going to turn on the mic now?
How did
the rehearsal go?
Yeah. So we can start now.
Well, we're all big, you know, we do this every week. We talk about science fiction. We talk about, you know, the future. And so having you here and having these same type of discussions with you is just amazing. So I'm very happy that you came and talked to us tonight. And I want to come over and see your museum.
I'm coming over for Bela Lugosi's ring.
Yeah, that's just amazing.
Is the check in the mail?
Yeah. We'll put the check in the mail.
Don't cash it until next week, though.
Now, people should know that you will be at Worldcon next week.
Yes.
You will be at ChillerCon in October, New Jersey.
Yes.
And you're going to Thailand for a cameo in a film in December.
Wow.
Which film?
That's right. It's a fantasy film called The White Elephant. And I'll take an 18-hour flight to Bangkok.
Wow.
And I don't know exactly what I do or say, but obviously they feel like I'm important enough to fly me there and feed me and put me up in a hotel.
That's a good free trip.
It's a great free
trip. For you to say vacation. No.
And for those of you out there who are interested in finding out more about Forrest, you can find him on the website on Wikipedia. There's an entry, as well as we will link to your website. And I understand that there's even somewhere there they can find out if they want to write you directly. There's an email address as well. Is that correct?
You can write to me at scifibiz, all one word, at AOL.com.
Perfect.
I have quite a ether correspondence going on with fans around the world.
Excellent. Well, there's also pictures on your website, and it's a great website, so everyone has to go and check it out.
And you can find
Ether correspondence.
And
Ether Core could be it.
Every Saturday for the last 50 years, during which time 50,000 fans have visited me, I have an open house on Saturday morning from 11 till noon. You don't have to call in advance. Just come between 11 and noon, no charge.
And you can see the cape and all the other memorabilia.
I might come this Saturday.
Yeah, I think
I'm going to stop by Saturday. because I've got to see those things. So,
well, thank me you. Too. Me too. I have to see them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Boris.
Brilliant.
This guy. Okay, we did this show out of order because we didn't want to be here at midnight with this guy who's 90 years old. But
and great.
We went out to dinner with this guy afterwards, and I wish we had
more microphones.
This guy was so awesome to hear all these stories that if we just lost all this material, I would still feel like it was worth sitting here. I mean, it was just unfreaking believable.
Yeah. And we've got to go see his collection.
Oh,
yeah.
We're going.
Yeah. And we will see his collection on Saturday. We will post it up on the website as well.
We got to find a way to get him to tell that Isaac Asimov story that he told at the restaurant. Because that was genius.
Yeah, I mean, this guy...
That was genius.
He was telling Isaac Asimov's stories. He was
Orson Welles' Close Encounter with a Coconut Cream Pie.
Yeah, the restaurant on our on the corner here, Orson Welles used to frequent that he knew. I mean, it's just
I want to go with him to the Scientology Celebrity Center for brunch.
Heck yeah. Can we link this episode to Scientology?
Do
we want them involved?
I'm going to go put posts on their website saying, you know, we discuss L. Ron Hubbard.
So, yeah, exactly. Okay. Well.
No, listen, you know, we actually, you know, I never mind.
He's speechless. I want everybody out there. I mean, this is this is an amazing interview. This fan of science fiction, this patron of science fiction.
Yeah, we all just hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we did doing it. We had a genuinely wonderful time on this interview.
Yeah, and go out there and spread the word about this interview. If you know anybody who's a fan of science fiction, they I'm sure would be a fan of this interview. So go spread the word and go to our website www.geekson.com. There's forums there. The last episode, we have pages and pages of people commenting on the forums. Great dialogue.
We have a continuing contest right now. If you want to win a Game of Thrones, the board game.
Now, soon to be a collector's item due to the fact
no,
that...
No, no,
no. It's not?
Different game.
Oh,
that's the role-playing game has been discontinued.
Oh, the role-playing game has been discontinued.
I got confused, too. I was the one that started the whole confusion.
Ah, you confused.
We are giving you the
man.
Board game. Go to geekson.com and you find the little forum string there talking about George R.R. Martin.
Yes.
We did an interview with him last episode. Go listen to it. It's amazing, too.
So if you post at least once in the forums with the topic of the episode, George R.R. Martin, and you post at least once, you will be entered into our contest, which we will be drawing next episode.
Great.
So get it in there. Multiple names and posts will not get you more chances. One name goes in.
Got it, Kalis?
The nude pictures of yourself sent to us at... Oh, no, wait.
No, don't.
But definitely go there. And you can also email us at geeks@geekson.com, or you can mail us individually with our names at geekson.com. But definitely go to the website. We have links and news and all sorts of goodies there.
And nude pictures.
Anything else?
Have a great geek week.
Yeah. Excellent. Have a great geek week, everybody.
Be well.
We'll try to do the next episode sooner.
Geek it out.
Okay, bye.